Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. And talk about fever. We have fashion fever this evening. Wait until you hear my guest that's coming up this evening. But before I can get to that, here I am. It's Lenny Godfrey talking to you, and you know I always do that little housekeeping so that people who are tuning in for the first time can really get the information of many of the back episodes and learn how to maneuver into this radio program if they have any questions or if they want to stop in and say hello. So the first thing is that to know that you're on blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, the number 2. And what that gives you is access to almost 30 episodes that we have been doing since March. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful run. And then you have to know that if you want to call in this evening or any evening, you call in 516-453-6063 and you press number 1 if you have a question or if you have something else to say. Now that I've gotten that out of the way, let me tell you a little bit about my guest tonight. First, before I even say his name, let me say to you that he and his wife are responsible for my husband and I changing our lifestyle and moving to the most wonderful, lovely part of Pennsylvania that we live in now. I met my guest on a bus in New York City. We were both taking a bus back home after an evening of theater or celebration. And I wasn't going to say anything to him. And then his coat fell open a little bit and I saw he had a tux on. And I went, oh, well, anybody has a tux, I know I can speak with them. So that started a conversation that was probably almost 20 years ago, and we've been friends ever since then. But now let me introduce you to my wonderful, wonderful, talented, style-setting, fashion expert friend, Mr. Bruce Boyer. Now let me tell you a little bit about him. We could go on for a half hour, but I'm just going to try to keep it as short as I possibly can. First, he's been associated with the Town and Country magazine as the men's fashion editor. He's written articles for Esquire, Harper's Bazaar, The New York Times, The New Yorker. He's had several books, one Intimately Suitable, that's a classic. The other is The History and Principles of Classic Menswear. We have a history of fashion in cinema, which is Rebel Style Cinematic Histories of the Heroes of the 50s. And then I know personally, because I have some of these books myself, he's got books on Fred Astaire, Gary Cooper. This man is what you call an enduring stylist, and that's one of the names of his book. He is always flawless in his presentation. He's a wonderful human being, I believe, an activist, and he doesn't even know it. He's also a person who is a music enthusiast, and we'll talk about that. And with all of that said, I'd like to welcome my friend, Mr. Bruce Boyer. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Lenny. Listening to that introduction, I had two thoughts, and one was, gee, I don't know who that guy is, but he sounds interesting.
Well, I didn't even say all of it. We still have to talk about FIT. We have so much to talk about, European travels,
well,
everything like that.
That's great. But my second thought was, oh boy, I must be listening to my obituary. So,
no, neither one of those things.
Well, anyway, you know, thank you for having me on. I thought you'd never ask.
Well, Bruce, you know, I had to really go get my program on the road before I start messing with people like you, you know, because if I don't get it right, I'll be hearing about it for many, many moons to come. So now
oh,
I know
I,
that
I
I'm
never
on the
let
right
you live
foot.
It down. I never
I know
let
it.
You live it down.
I know that's true. So that's why I had to be very careful with it, let me tell you. But now I've said to people and I've told them now all of the things that you do now, but I want to give them a background. You know, I already start. I want to go backwards. Let me take you all the way back in time when you were a child. Tell us where did your childhood begin? Right? Where are your childhood memories?
Well, now, I mean, we're going back, you know, 300 or 400 years, you know, to my birth.
Yes.
I was actually a World War II baby. I was born during the war in Wildwood, New Jersey.
Ah.
And
okay.
Yeah. And you know, I keep thinking that I was the only person ever born in Wildwood. A lot of people are conceived there.
And why? Why? What is it about Wildwood?
My father had a grocery store in Wildwood. And I'm not sure how he met my mother, because my mother is from this part of the world. And I think she must have been there on vacation, you know, like so many people have done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At that
mm-hmm.
time in the 1940s, Atlantic City and Wildwood and a couple of the other small towns along the shore were very hot tourist destinations, you know. After that period, after the war, and once we had jet planes, I mean, people started to go to Europe and all sorts of places. But before that, the Jersey Shore was the place to go, you know. And so he was a grocer in Wildwood, and I think my mother was there on vacation, and they met, and so forth. And here we are. So that's where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents, unfortunately, divorced a while after that, and I moved with my mother to this area, actually, because that's where she was from.
I see.
That's the long story short of it.
Well, now, given that you are now in this area, when did the sparks of the artistic world become knowledgeable to you? When did you start thinking about the arts? Because we're going to talk about fashion, but it's not just fashion. It's
yes.
music with you. I have so many CDs and so many books that you've given me, and we talk
yeah.
about music all the time. So when did all
yes.
that start for you?
Well, I grew up on the south side of Allentown, and I really don't know why the south side of Allentown at that time was such a wonderful place. But I can tell you that the two things that in a way influenced me so much and which I still love, fashion and music, I picked up there. The people in that little community were very interested in dressing. I think the reason is, you know, I have given this a lot of thought, and I think you'll agree with me because you know what I'm talking about, that the south side of Allentown was not a wealthy neighborhood, to say the least. It was very blue-collar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you are talking about people in, I hate to use the word lower-class communities, but I'm not sure what else to use.
Oh, it's the working class.
Working class. That's much better. Thank you. In a working-class community, you know, the idea of dignity and respect becomes very important. You know,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, especially in that time period. Appearances are very, very important. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when people went out to a party or a restaurant or whatever, they dressed because they wanted to show a certain dignity and respect. So that was one thing. And for some reason, as I say, I'm not quite sure, we also heard all sorts of music. I think maybe because, you know, the Lehigh Valley is kind of situated almost midway between Philadelphia and New York, you know.
Yes.
So, but at any rate, I mean, I, from a very, very early age, I listened to rhythm and blues and pop music and swing and Latin music. I tell you, I think probably the only music that I didn't get a chance to listen to was classical music and opera. You know, there wasn't a lot of opera in the working class community at that time. You know,
right? Yes.
But it all came from that. That particular culture, I don't know how quite to explain it. It was just there that all the young people that I grew up with, I think so many of them had an interest in deporting themselves well, and there were some great dancers, you know. We went to dances 2-3 times a week.
Well, it sounds very much like the Harlem Renaissance, the working class community.
Yeah,
it wasn't
that good, but kind of.
Yeah, I mean, but that culturally, it's interesting when you talk about a period of time of the things that we had in common. And I remember my parents telling me when I was a little girl, when they moved to New York City, and it was after World War II, when my father had told my mother to come from South and move up before I was born. And they said that you never locked the doors. People would just knock and come on in.
Exactly.
That people, you know, the neighborhood and the expectations of what you look like, how you presented yourself, sounds very much like the South Side of Allentown, which is very, very interesting because Harlem was a working class community. And then you had the upper class in Sugar Hill and in Stryver's Row. And there were sections like in Allentown, there's sections where there's a little bit more of prosperity, but the bulk of it and the bulk of the culture that drove the community were those people and what they represented. So it sounds very much like the Harlem Renaissance, the time. So where you get your love of music and jazz. I don't know. I have, what is it, 5 books here that you've given me so that. You know,
And I've got a couple of more for you.
Well, you always do, which is fabulous because it keeps me, you know, I discover musicians that I don't know. I discover music that I hadn't heard. And this is from someone who doesn't perform it like I do, but is an enthusiast. And now I want to So stay into that time. So now let's put you in high school age. You went to high school in the area when you finished high school.
I went to William Allen High School. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right here. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And when you finished, what did you do?
Well, I was one of the many kids that I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was, 18 years old, and I was as confused as you could be at 18, you know. Mm-hmm. And my mother, to her great wisdom, said to me, look, I'm going to make you a deal. I would like you to go to college for a year and try it. And if you don't like it, then you can go and do whatever you want to do,
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I said, well, that seems pretty good to me. And she and my grandparents had saved some money for that. So it was very, very good of them. And so I hadn't been much interested in school learning, I guess. I kind of learned on my own. I read books and things on my own. I didn't really care too much about school. But when I got to college, it absolutely inspired me. I loved it. I loved all of the courses I took. I loved all of the professors. It just was, I had never been exposed to, people who were interested in intellectual discussions about real things and who were that bright and so forth. And boy, that was just terrific for me. I loved it. And as it happened, I don't want to brag, but I graduated in the top 10 in my class from college, and then I went on to university graduate school.
Well, where did you go? Where did you go to? Which college and school?
I went to college and graduate school here in this area. I went to Moravian for 4 years, and
mm-hmm.
then I got an MA in English from Lehigh. And
university, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then actually I went into higher education teaching. I taught at Moravian for, I think, 3 years, and I taught at St. Francis de Sales for 4 years.
Mm.
So, up until that point, I was thinking that I would be an English teacher, in higher education.
But then what happened? Because, when I met you, you had all the books. You had started writing the books then. What turn happened in life?
Yeah. Well, what happened was that while I was teaching courses in literature, but I hadn't really thought about writing anything, although reading what other writers had done was my prime enjoyment, I guess you could say. But anyway, what I discovered, and this this is so funny because it makes me seem more like an idiot than anything I can actually think of. It took me those 7 years, the 3 years teaching at one place and four at another. It
mm-hmm.
took me 7 years to realize that I wasn't really a good scholar. I was a good teacher, and as it turned out later, I think I wasn't a bad writer, but I was not a good scholar. And the reality is that when you're in higher education like that, there's an awful lot of emphasis on scholarship, you know.
Yes.
And there should be.
Yes.
There
academic.
Should be,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Academic.
You know, you expect that. And I just wasn't a very good scholar, and I really didn't care about scholarship too much. So I realized that my days in teaching were going to be numbered, and they were. And so I found myself in my 30s, again, not knowing what I was going to do. That seems to be a theme in my life, Lenny, you know, not knowing what the hell I'm going to do, you know.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that it seems that the English in your life came to play because you could utilize it in your writing. And so, therefore, those 7 years, I think that they were, it's a 7-year cycle that you had, and that you had acquired what you needed to acquire in order to move on and morph into where you became the author that you became. But see, my curiosity is knowing that you taught school, because we talked about that, but going from this now place where you realize education and the academics are not your forte, even though you could exist in it, but you were brave enough, I believe, to say, instead of just staying in it and just settling in it like a lot of people do, wishing that they could go someplace else, you decided you would make a transition, not knowing what the transition was going to be. So my question is, what happened so you realized that writing was where you were heading for?
Well, you're absolutely right in saying that I used what I had been doing as a teacher to bring to writing. What happened was, I try to make this as short as I can, is that in that type of a world, you know, higher academics, you don't actually get fired. They simply don't renew your contract. You know, it's
okay.
A subtle difference, but, you know, it comes to the same thing. Anyway, so they didn't renew my contract, and this was actually 1972, and I remember it so clearly because the Duke of Windsor died that year. You know, he was the a king who gave up his throne to marry the woman he loved, you know.
Sure.
He abdicated the throne of Britain.
Sure.
And I was kind of interested in him because he was kind of what they used to call a fashion plate. You know, he was a trendsetter and a style setter and all of that. And so I got interested in him, and I started, he had written a couple of books too, and I had read all of them and so forth. And now in 1972, he died. And I started to read, every magazine had an article about him because he was a hero to some and much less of a hero to others. But I knew a lot about him, I thought. And I read these articles that were coming out about him, and I said, well, that doesn't really capture him, you know, the way it should. So I sat down and I wrote a piece about him, trying to explain him in terms of his style. And now I had this 4,000-word article, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I said, well, I'm going to send it to a magazine, see if they publish it. And I remember I sent it to two magazines. I sent it to Town and Country, and I sent it to Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
And I must tell you, the only reason I sent it to Playboy was because somebody told me they paid twice as much as everybody else. So I thought, well, that would be fine, you know. I didn't even know that anybody read Playboy. You know, I thought they just looked at the pictures. But anyway, so I got a note back from Town and Country, and they said, oh, well, we'll buy this piece. And I thought, oh, my God, that's wonderful. So I quickly sat down, and I wrote another piece, and I sent that to them, too. I think at first they must have thought I was on drugs or something, you know. But they sent me another note back saying, we like this, too. We'll buy this, and will you come to New York and talk with us? It just happened that the year or two before, they had gotten a new editor in chief, and this guy, whose name was Frank Zachary, and I'm always grateful to him, he was the kind of an editor that he was looking for new talent, and he whatever he read that he thought was interesting, he would invite you in. So I went to New York, and I talked with him and a couple of other people there, the managing editor, and they all agreed that I should write a feature men's fashion piece for them every other issue. Well, I got to tell you, I walked out of there that day. I was absolutely on a cloud. I'll tell you how much of a cloud I was on. At that time, the Town and Country offices were at 56th and 5th Avenue, and right across the street, there was a department store that's no longer there, Bonwit Teller.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the, yeah, it was one of the great department stores in New York.
Yeah.
I walked out of the Town and Country offices. I walked across the street into Bonwit Teller, and I bought the most expensive men's suit they had on the rack. Now, the real punchline to this story is, I got the suit, I got measured for it and everything, and they said they would send it to me. And so I walked out of the store, and I forgot to ask how much it cost. Can you imagine? It was horribly expensive, I found out. But I was so much on a cloud, you know, getting this job with Town and Country, and that they liked what I was doing and so forth, that I didn't even ask what things cost. To finish this up very quickly, I didn't ask Town and Country what they were going to pay me either. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. But I ended up being with them for about 15 years.
Well, obviously they did well. You did well by them. They did well by you. And you were able to pay for that suit. And so, but that was the universe.
Yes, eventually. Eventually I found out what they were going to pay me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. You know, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And also that was just the sign of the universe telling you which way to go. That was just the beginning of showing you that was where your career was headed more than anything else. It's obvious to me. In hindsight, I can say that. I wouldn't have known to say that back in those days, you know. But in hindsight, I could say, well, then that's a big signal. So you're at Town and Country, and you did it for 15 years. While you were there, were you writing books also?
Well, I started off just writing for them, and then I was on the masthead as, a men's fashion editor and a contributing editor. And then I started to do little jobs for other people. You know, I would write some menswear ads for the clothing stores in New York, and I'd write some press kits for, you know, some designer, or do these little other jobs. And then in a couple of years, I had written so much and was a little bit, you know, more connected and had more ideas and so forth. And I went to my editor, Frank Zachary, and I said to him, Frank, you know, I've got these ideas and I've got a couple of pieces and so forth under my belt now. I said, I'd like to do a book. And he said, I think that's a good idea, Bruce. And he said, I'll put you in touch with an agent who's a friend of mine. And he did. And it was a young lady who was, I think, even younger than I was at the time. Her name was Robin Strauss, and she was a great agent in New York. She had her own agency, and she helped me get my first book published. So you know, what's so interesting, I think, about all this when I think of it, it's kind of frightening when you think how much luck plays, you know?
And how much
you depend upon other people, you know?
Yes.
I always think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, he's a self-made man. She's a self-made woman. I just never believe that. You know, there's so many people involved in making you what you are. You know, starting with your parents, of course, but, you know, along the line, I'm sure you would feel that way too, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I truly do believe my life has always been, and one episode after another, of my stumbling into things. I'm a big planner, but, you know, as they say, if you want to see God laugh or smile, have a plan. I have a plan, but my plan, it's always a variation. It gets me to those places, but never the way I planned it. I'm always stumbling into someone who's wonderful or stumbling into a situation. So absolutely, you could tell by, you know, the story about your mother, how she just thought, let me let you just take a taste of something you weren't used to and see how you reacted to it and what kind of blessing that was to have someone in your life that would be like that. That's absolutely incredible.
You know, we both agree about that, and I'm glad you brought up the idea of, you know, being prepared, because yes, I mean, and that's the only thing you can do is prepare yourself, you know, and then hope that you get lucky. I tell you, I have always felt that the more prepared I am, the luckier I get. You know what I mean?
Yes. You know, the discipline of preparation is very important. It is, because when opportunities come your way, even if you haven't planned them, you then have you have the ability to look them in the eye and say, I can do this. I can do this because I can apply my discipline and I can make this work. Without the discipline, without them having some kind of plan in which you have implemented in yourself that says, I have this behind me, I have this as a foundation. When someone comes to you, you don't have anything to draw on, so you then bypass the opportunity. And does not come.
Well, that's
time,
exactly. You know? I'm sure that, you know, when somebody came to you and said, well, we would like you to be in this Broadway play, that your first thought was, oh my God, but your second thought was, I can do it because I have been prepared for this. I've been waiting.
Yeah, I had prepared. I'd been on the road. I knew the music.
Yeah.
I knew the era. I knew everything. Even though I was going to be entering into a cast of people who had all of them had far more experience than I did, and now are just beginning to discover that it was, you know, I really had very little experience. I was out of college there. They all thought that I'd been doing it for a while. And, I mean, I never divulged it until now that, no, I wasn't. I was just a little bit out of college. But during those years, those were preparation years. And all the years before, studying at Carnegie with Dr. Northern, studying with Lloyd Richards, all of those things were things that, you know, were constant, that was in my life, so that when I was approached with something, I said, yeah, I got that.
Well, I mean, you never know when somebody is going to tap you on the shoulder, you know, and say, can you do this? And you
exactly.
want to be able to say yes. Yes, I can.
Yes, I can. You know, I mean, this very thing that we're talking about where we are right now. At the beginning of the year, this was not an idea in my mind at all. I was just asked to do one of these. And then when I saw how comfortable and personable it was, and you know, and I was sent an invitation to say, well, do you think you have an interest in it? And I thought, me have an interest in this, you know, but because of all the background, because the pandemic had made me really go into another form of art, which was working with the camera and talking to people, the foundation was there. So there I go. I'm stumbling again. And here I am, stumbled. You know.
Yeah, well, I think that's what you want to, you know, we want to tell young people that you want to be prepared when and if luck strikes you.
Yes, yes. That, you know, preparation is probably, you know, one of the most important things that you have, studying and being prepared. Now, I remember I told you that this, we have about only 20 minutes left. You know, in our
conversation. Okay, we'll have to talk faster.
No, you don't have to talk faster. I can always have you back on, see? But
okay.
I do want to, I mean, I've gotten you writing now, but what I've always asked you, and I always told you, we've had conversations about, was what attracted you, not to fashion, but men's fashion in particular, because you are such a person, you are such a stylist that I could see that you could be, and when you did the exhibit at FIT, which I want to talk about, please, the emphasis on female costuming was just as important as male costuming. But why men's fashion? Why men's fashion?
Well, that's it, you know, to talk about a fella's interest in female fashion is easy. You say, well, I just like girls, you know, that's, you know, and that takes care of that. As far as my interest in male fashion, yes, I've given this some thought too. And I think what happened, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in a working class community. And it was a pretty rough little place. Almost all of the older men were steel workers. You know, they were tough guys. I mean, they moved hot pig iron around all day, you know. It was a rough place. And I happened to be a skinny little kid. I was skinny for my age and scrawny. And so I was at a little bit of a disadvantage, you know, and what you do, I think, regardless, what you do growing up is you look for, I don't know what it, but I'm going to use the word weapons. You look for weapons that you can use in your struggle to, you know, make your way in society. Mm-hmm. And I was not tall, dark, or handsome. I was none of that. And I wasn't a tough kid, and so forth. So I said, you know, you gotta find some way to do two things. One, to stop the guys from beating you up, and second, to get familiar with some girls if you can. You know, I mean, those were my two aims in life. to stop being beaten up and to meet a couple of nice gals. So I watched what the older guys were doing, and I noticed that some of the older guys, they just got more respect than others. They got more attention than others, and it was because they had a style. They had their style. It was the way they dressed, the way they walked, the way they smoked cigarettes, the way they combed their hair. You know, all of that. You could just see that some of them got more attention than others, and it was style. So I said, well, you know, maybe I can do that. So I started to pay attention, and I dressed a little better, and I paid more attention to that kind of thing. And I think that's really where it began, that I'm a great one for understanding image. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I'm good at understanding images, what images tell us. And you know, that kind of, so I developed that, and I must tell you that it worked. I got a little more respect from the fellas, and I met some wonderful ladies, but we
and
won't go
married,
into that.
You're married.
I'm married to one
you,
of them. Yeah, I'm married to the most wonderful lady.
Yes, I believe so. Miss Pam is the best. She is absolutely beautiful and the best. Yes.
She's my boss, of course, you know.
Oh, of course. Well, you need a boss because you.
I do.
But when I think about your life, where do you think you would be if the arts had not influenced you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I probably, you know, that job at Town and Country hadn't come around, and I couldn't make it as a fashion writer and so forth, I think I probably would have ended up teaching in public school somewhere, teaching English in public school somewhere, and been very unhappy. Very unhappy, just because it wasn't for me. Yeah, I'll tell you, I shudder to think what might have happened. I am absolutely the luckiest person you'll ever meet. Really, I can't tell you.
I think there are many of us, you know, I of course wanted to be a teacher very early in my life, and until I was a freshman in college, that's where I was going, and that was my entire life. Being introduced to actually presentational theater is what changed it, but the arts, you know, the arts made even the thought of teaching a wonderful idea for me because of the simple fact that there is an art in teaching. There are those people who the art of teaching is what they were born for. And there are those of us where we veer away from it. But I also think about what life would be like if I had not utilized the foundations that I had gotten from the mentors that had faith in me and said, go, you know, you can do this. You can do this dialogue and make it real. You can take these lyrics and this melody line and make that real. I think without the arts and any art, even the arts of teaching, my life, I don't know who I would be.
No, but two things. First of all, you know, if you had been doing something else, it wouldn't be as nurturing. And secondly, you wouldn't be as happy.
I agree with you there. I do agree.
Right.
But and saying all this now, I want to say, because we have several listeners, this is the time, if you have a question, this is the time to ask the question, because we're getting down to the last 10, 15, less than 15 minutes now. And it will give Bruce enough time to think about it and to give you a viable answer, or if you
okay.
want to come in and say something. So just to let you know, no one has come up yet, but they might come in the next 5 minutes and ask us a question. So,
yeah.
All right. But now to get back to where we were. So with all of this, who do you think Bruce Boyer is now?
Well, yeah, good question. Well, there are a couple answers to that. The first thing that occurs to me, there's a little boy inside of me yelling, "What the hell have you done to us?" You know, because it's so terrible. The body gets old, but there's still a young person inside of you. You know, I remember reading that Oscar Wilde said, the great tragedy is not that we grow old, but that we don't.
Yes.
Something to think
yes.
about.
Yes.
You know, I
yeah.
mean, our bodies grow old, but we don't, you
no.
know.
No.
So
no.
One answer would be, well, I'm still a little kid who gets a big kick out of reading a new well-written book or listening to some music, you know. And if I could move my body the way I used to, I would take Pam out dancing. You know, when I was a kid, I was a great dancer.
Mm.
Did you know that about me?
No, I didn't know that about you.
Oh, I taught the South Side how to mambo.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I was a great dancer, and I loved it. I mean, I would go to dances 2-3 times a week, and it was one of the most joyous things that I think I've ever experienced. And I think that is what, in fact, led me to my great love of music generally, you know.
I was going to ask you where did the music come in? Because the music is also a great part of your life.
Yes. I remember when I was a very young child that my uncle, I had four uncles and three of them were physicians.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them had a collection of records. You know, it was, at that time, it was big band swing music, you know. Glenn Miller and Jimmy Lunsford and Count Basie and that kind of stuff. And he would let me listen to his records when I visited him and my aunt. And I just really loved that. And then later on when I was a teenager, my mother bought me one of those little 45 players, those 40 plastic, they were brown plastic 45 players. They cost about $8 at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
and the 45 records, the retail price was 99 cents, but if you looked around carefully, you could find them for 49 cents. So I would listen to those, and then went to some school dances. And so I just became enamored of music. And as I say, for some reason, which I can't entirely explain, on the South Side, we could get all kinds of music. I remember listening to, for example, blues music, long before it became popular on college campuses in the 60s and 70s. And I remember listening to Latin music before people were even dancing to it. I mean, non-Latin people were dancing to it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's been one of the great loves of my life, because I find it a refuge when I'm troubled. I find it a joy when I'm feeling well. I think some music is incredibly profound. I've always thought that great lyricists should be taught as poetry, you know, great lyrics.
Yes.
Like Lorenz Hart, for example. You know,
mm-hmm.
my God, what a poet that man was. I
yes.
mean, it should be taught in literature courses.
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
There are
several lyricists that I believe that not only should they be taught, but actors and singers can take the lyrics and make them into monologues. They're so prolific and wonderful to work with. And it makes you understand the songs.
You're certainly in the class of you can take a lyric and reveal the emotion in it. You know, you're one of the best I know at that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I look forward to getting back to doing that, to looking forward to doing it. You know,
yes, you better.
It's one of those storytelling episodes that is absolutely wonderful. When you get the opportunity to work on a song like Johnny Mercer, who's from Savannah, Georgia, and what he did to Midnight Sun, where it was an instrumental, and then he put the lyrics to it and made it a whole nother, you know, hit. Those kinds of things, the discovery of that as an artist is unbelievable. There's an art form in that that's absolutely incredible when you listen to the history of things like that.
Well, I was thinking of a song that I've heard you do, Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life.
Yes.
And I mean, yes. But you know, that song is almost a novel in itself. You know,
it is.
It's so profound. And
yes.
How old was he when he wrote that? Somebody said he was 17. Is that right?
Well, he wrote it in 5 years. So he started at 16 and he finished at 22.
Oh, my God. I don't see how anybody that young can understand life that well. Do you?
When you dissect. Not only is it a prolific piece of music, but you dissect it because it comes in three parts. So it's like three different movements. And I think that's why I enjoy doing it so well, because, you know, there's an introductory movement, then there's an emotional movement, and then there's one where there's eventually the solution, the evolution of the whole song ends. And so it has a great movement to it. That I attack when I think about that song and what it says and the journey of love and his journey of love and love unrequited and love lost and to be that young and to feel that much of pain, I'll die somewhere where, you know, where everyone has their lush life. It's the lyrics in themselves just reach out to you, and I think you hear his pain through them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a very it's a very emotionally difficult song, as well as being a very difficult song technically, right?
Yes. No. Yes. Yes, it is. You know, I do it in the original key where, I've forgotten. No, it's the wonderful, the two of the Coltrane and,
Johnny Hartman.
Johnny Hartman, thank you. See, this
Johnny
is what I
Hartman,
mean.
Yeah.
It's Johnny Hartman's key. I do it in Johnny Hartman's key. and the original D-flat, I think it is. And so,
yes.
You know.
Well, Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane's version is almost as good as yours.
Well, thank you, from your lips to God's ears. But it was listening to, to those men separately and together as they composed that. And, you know, I say to anyone listening, if you've not heard Lush Life by them, you should listen to it. It's absolutely phenomenal, you know.
Well, I think Johnny Hartman was Coltrane's favorite singer.
I think so, too. But, okay, who is before we're getting down to the last minutes, but I have to ask you, because now I've forgotten, you exposed me to, what's his name, horn player.
Baker?
Chet Baker. My God.
Chet Baker, yes.
Yes, yeah, I mean, just absolutely incredible, you know. I suggest to people also go and listen to Chet Baker, you know. He's incredible. What a life, though. What a story.
Incredible is right. You know, you look at the early pictures of Chet. He was as handsome as James Dean, you know.
Yes, he was.
And then he became addicted to drugs, and it just went downhill, terrible. But
another toll on his life. You see, we're down to less than 3 minutes, and I'm going to have to curtail our conversation because I knew that we'd get on music and fashion, and we didn't talk about FIT, and we didn't talk about what you're getting ready to do. Just briefly, tell us, you know, what you're thinking about doing. We were talking about it off air. A little bit of the projects that you're
doing. Well, what I'm doing, I have three book ideas, and I've been working on all three of them. One is a music book, a collection of my music pieces. Another one is this idea, which I mentioned earlier, that I want to do a book about fashion in the 1950s. And then thirdly, I have a third idea for a book on American fashion that I haven't really worked it out in my mind yet. But those three projects are keeping me busy.
Well, I bet they are. Well, you know, I can't tell you how wonderful this has been to have this conversation with you. This is what our conversations are like. Either before or after one of my concerts, you know, I usually perform, and then Bruce and I have the post conversation about what he thought about this song and what did that song work, and did it, and picking songs for me sometimes that are obscure and having me dissect them, and it's just a wonderful relationship, and I can't thank you enough for being my friend and sharing that love of music for me and exposing me to the fashion. Because it's another love that I have. So it's just a great unit. And thank goodness we started talking on that bus many, many years ago.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have to thank Port Authority.
Yes, we do.
Right? We don't want to, but we have to.
Yes, we do. We do have to thank Port Authority. Well,
I love you madly. And I thank you so much for having me on. It was my pleasure entirely, I'm telling you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so very much. Well, we're not going to continue this on Zoom this time, but we're going to have you back and have you talk some more about it, you know.
We talk about FIT and so forth.
Yes, we have to. We have to. But thank
you
so much,
Bruce. I'd love it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, my love fan. And I'm going to thank everyone for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Next week, we have one of the Phantoms of Broadway, Davis Gaines, all the way from California, is going to be talking to us. So we'll see you on the radio, everyone. Thank you again. Bye-bye now.
Everybody's got the feeling. all know fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling.